we are back with episode 508 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I'm not sure that slowly reconstituting the House of Battiatus is going to work out quite like all of our plans.
No, probably not, but I will say that at the very least, it looks like he's putting together his own little Justice League, and he's telling DC where he can stuff it.
Yes.
But at any rate, we are going to go ahead and start off the week a little bit light. Gary hopefully will be along shortly. I know that, unfortunately, Bronstomp is unable to join us. However, we are going to pave forward as we can. And that begins with, I guess, we're going to start off with a little bit of a description of what we typically do. First of all, we begin with a bit of news for genre that came out this particular week. Then we go into a break, and then we will be going through the top three for the week as far as our scored shows are concerned. And then we'll be discussing the bottom three, and then we'll see where it goes from there. I think we have a few surprises up our sleeve. But hopefully this will give us a little more time to talk about things that are not just episodic in nature. So that's kind of the way that the week's going to pan out. But before we go any further than that or talk any more about Arrow or anything else, Edmund, why don't you go ahead and give us the usual disclaimer?
Absolutely. I do need to warn you that when we talk about these things, we like to talk about anything that might have happened, so we will be horribly, judiciously spoilerific. But we always try and wait a week or so before we do that to you, so we hope you've had a chance to see everything.
That's right, that's right. And as we said, we're going to go ahead and start with genre news. And I'm going to start here with some good news for fans of Benedict Cumberbund and his work on Sherlock. He has no plans to quit Sherlock, although he seems to be starring in just about everything. As it says right here at the top of the article, that he is a high-flying Hollywood actor now, but that doesn't mean he's going to abandon the show that probably brought him most fans in recent years. So it looks like while Sherlock may only come out every couple decades at a time, well, what, a one-shot special that comes out next year? And then a fourth series sometime after that? Yeah, who knows? All we know is that he's going to be obviously reprising his role as Smaug in the last Hobbit movie coming up in just a few days. So any thoughts on that, considering his ubiquitous nature these days?
Yeah, well, while I'm happy to hear that he is still committed to it, we still have the unfortunate consequence of whenever it fits into his schedules and Martin's schedules. So, yes, I'm happy he's going to continue, but I'm not happy about the fact that we have to wait for them.
Yes, there is that unfortunate side to the story, isn't there? Yeah, I don't think any of us are particularly pleased with that. But there we are. If you could take the next one, please.
Absolutely. The Walking Dead. We've been hearing much about rumors about the spinoff that is going to be coming. And we apparently have cast our first leads. We have Frank DeLay. The series, which apparently has the code name at the moment anyway of Cobalt, or is this in fact the name, a.k.a. Cobalt? Anyway, we'll center on a male divorce teacher and a female guidance counselor. Frank DeLane will play the woman's son struggling with a drug problem, and Alicia Debnam Carey from Into the Storm, her ambitious daughter. And notes that the young lady was apparently previously cast in AMC's rejected science fiction and fantasy pilot, Galentine, which was apparently so rejected we never even heard rumors about it. And they have ordered a pilot, and we will just wait with bated breath to see what they come up with.
Yes, I suppose we will. I like the fact that with the one actress, her previous credit was Into the Storm. Talk about jumping up in quality of script, if nothing else.
Yes.
All right. Well, talking about jumping up in quality, hopefully, or at least jumping back in quality, we have Marvel's Agent Carter coming back with a 2-hour premiere. The 6th of January, that is a Tuesday, I'm guessing that is due to the fact that it's supposed to be in the same time slot as Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. However, it's going to be a 2-hour premiere, so I'm not sure what it's going to be bumping. But regardless, Agent Carter, although it is only, I believe, 8 episodes in total, it's going to start off with 2 episodes on Tuesday, January 6th. So everybody should make sure that they have their DVRs properly programmed. I guess that's the word for it, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, there we are. All right, and the next one, please.
Certainly.
Once the program allows you to do so, I suppose.
Yes. Well, no, I was just getting slightly confused. Are we jumping into space, or are we jumping into a different universe?
Oh, I skipped one there.
Yes.
why don't you go over the one that I skipped?
Okay. In other casting news, for Suicide Squad, this is the DC movie, not the the other Suicide Squad that is currently starring in the Arrow and Flashverse. We have Will Smith, Tom Hardy, Margot Robbie, and Jared Leto all lining up to play bad guys forced to be good. I was trying to get down to, okay, who is everybody playing? So the Jared Leto is going to take on the Joker. Will Smith is Deadshot. Margot Robbie is Harley Quinn. Jay Courtney as Boomerang, and Cara Delevingne as Enchantress. And Tom Hardy is playing Rick Flag. And David Ayer, who just released Fury, nice retro World War II movie. For anybody who didn't grow up watching World War II movies, you can just go and see Fury and see a modern version of it. But he is both writing the script and directing.
So Tom Hardy, the same guy who played Bane?
Yes.
Okay. In the same movie with Jared Leto taking on the Joker, and Will Smith is dead. I'm not sure whether or not to anticipate this or be terrified by it. And this is where we're definitely going to have to come back to this one a little bit when Gary joins us, because I really would like to get his opinion on it. So maybe I'll let it slide for right now, but call me somewhat skeptical.
Yes.
Yeah.
If
they're going for camp, maybe we've got something.
This might help you in that direction. I did just notice the update where they haven't announced the actor for the Amanda Waller role yet, but the rumor was that their top pick was Oprah Winfrey.
That's interesting. Okay.
Although Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer have also been mentioned, since I'm sure they're not really necessarily expecting they're going to get Oprah.
No, I would think not. So what's really kind of, I have this feeling, and maybe it's just that maybe I'm overstating the case slightly. I have this feeling that we're going to discover that this is DC's way of showing that Marvel is in fact in charge of establishing the comic book universes on the big screen, and they're just giving up. They're just not even going to try and outdo. They're just going to do what they've got to do. So, yeah, I don't know. There's some strangeness here. That's for sure. I kind of scratching my head about some of these casting choices, but be that as it may.
Yeah.
All right. One last piece here. As I said, we will definitely ask Gary what his thoughts are on this one. So one last piece here, and this is a little bit interesting. So Roberto Orci will not be directing Star Trek III. So apparently he has, this was supposed to be his directorial debut, of course,
yes.
But he basically is staying on as a producer and may still have a credit for writing the script, but he's basically just bailed rather abruptly on directing. Now there's a couple different things that I thought would be interesting to note here. First of all, didn't he also kind of surprisingly bail out on some of the things he was doing with, I believe it was the Spider-Man movies for Marvel not so long ago? And yeah, then he kind of, I'm wondering if he's just feeling like he bit off more than he could chew. But I also remember that there were some people that felt like he was not a great choice anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny how a lot of those same people were then like shocked and stunned and really worried over this news. And I was wondering, well, you were worried about the news. Why are you more worried now that he's not going to do it? But okay.
Yeah, it does seem like far too ambitious a project for a directorial debut. I mean, however much you've been, had your finger in all these different genre pies over the last decade or so, it seems.
Yeah, and to be fair, there's a lot of people, myself included, who have not been entirely happy with what he's been doing. But I also noticed that for better or worse, he's also burning a lot of his creative bridges here. Either, leaving one project, breaking up with his main writing partner,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it seems like he's really just disengaging himself from a lot of this stuff lately, which just I'm curious as to why that would be. But I think that this opens the door for somebody with a little bit more of a sure hand to take over the wheel.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's fine with me. So we'll see how that works out. Well, that's it for right now as far as our news goes. So we're going to go into our mid-show break. And when we come back, we will be starting off with some of our episodic discussion, basically going over our top three for the week. So stay tuned and you'll find out just what those turned out to be. All right, and we are back from our break, and we are ready to start our episodic discussion. And we're going to start with the show that was at the very top of our list this past week. And, Edmund, one thing that I noticed this week, and I don't know if it's because everybody's gearing up for or delivering their mid-season finales, but everything this week that we are covering was between either a 6.8, which was the lowest, so right around average, actually, just a hair below, all the way up to a 9.0. So, yeah. That's impressive. We're only talking about like 11 or 12 shows too. So a big, big swath, and a lot of them over, over the average mark and well over the average mark.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's, we always know to expect fireworks and sweeps time, but, we're definitely getting our fair share this, this last week.
That's right. And, well, I don't know that the people in this particular episode at the top of our list would say that they were getting a fair anything right now, but we'll still manage to cover it in hopefully a fair and balanced way. And this is the show that got a 9.0 average, and that's out of four scores, all came in at 9. So you know that this is definitely a matter of consensus. And that would be The Newsroom. And let's go ahead and run the promo.
What if I told you you could be the number one news network and change the world at the same time?
Telling personal stories doesn't take away from covering Syria and Afghanistan and Washington.
There has to be another buyer for this network.
What?
This can't be happening.
I don't know what you're looking at.
DOJ should not have let it go this far.
Would you tell the grand jury the name of the person you know to have stolen classified government documents?
No, sir, I won't.
All right, and Edmund, if you could do the recap, please.
Absolutely. This is the Newsroom's Season 3, Episode 4, Contempt. Will refuses to reveal the source of stolen government documents, even though he could go to jail for contempt. Meanwhile, Sloan and Max search for a last-minute buyer for ACN when Charlie's had it with Lucas. And Hallie's new job puts a strain on her relationship with Jim.
Mm-hmm. And like I said, we all came in at a 9 on this one, and it was definitely our highest-scored episode of the week. Well, where do we even begin? I guess we can use the recap as a little bit of a guide on this one, but how about we just say that it took everything from the previous episode that we thought was the Newsroom kind of distilled down to its essentials and just kept going at pretty much the same high level of pacing and just really, really disturbing conversations.
Yes. So. Yeah. And, but what I particularly liked was, that we were, it felt to me like for the first time in the show, getting to this point where we've learned about these characters, we've known something about their backstories, and, we were actually starting to dig a little deeper. What particularly hit it off for me was the Mac and Reese conversation early on, when Reese, you know, brings up, you know, for the first time anybody's actually said it out loud. It's like, you know, yeah, okay, Will's been a mess since you've been back. Trying to be the great journalist, and has he just been doing it for you this whole time? Which was certainly something that's been lurking in the background ever since, you know, it was her in the very first episode holding up the legal pad, once he actually realized it was her. That, to my mind, was the moment where there was some real nice revelation, and then I know this is jumping to the other end of the recap, but then the other one that kind of got to me was Jim's whole reaction with Hallie, where he was being such a complete jerk, to my mind it was almost like, you know, okay, you know, as I kind of suspected when we saw the outlines for these episodes, that yes, Hallie's new job at what is he calling it, Carnivore, is really is Sorkin's vehicle to just sound off against all the things he hates about the internet. But I kind of love the fact that he winds up doing it all through Jim, who just does not come off very well in the whole exchange at all. So
putting it mildly, right?
Yeah. You know, so it was almost like you say, you know, like, you know, yes, I really want to sound off about this, but I know what a crotchety old man I sound like when I do it. So I'm going to acknowledge that too.
I definitely see where he's going with this, and I think that anyone who has any kind of self-reflection on this whole topic is seeing that there is a certain degree of lack of journalistic integrity that internet bloggers can fall into quite often. I just think myself about the number of people that I know personally who fall into this trap of only looking at certain blogs on the internet for news, and mm-hmm. it just happens to be the ones that align completely with their own bias, and they can't see for the life of them that it is what it is. At the same time, that's not exactly what we have going here. Instead, we have this really just rapacious kind of commentary blog that you see for politics and entertainment and the intersection thereof. And I have to say, for someone who loathes it to the degree that he does, Sorkin does a really good job representing it. But it, oh, you know, it makes you just wonder. It's like, how well have you been studying the target of your fanaticism on this one? But that all being said, I did feel like there was a bit. It was a bit much the way that Jim was coming across. I felt like, yes, he can be a bit of a jerk, but here's where I sometimes wonder with Sorkin, and even though I gave this a 9, so it clearly didn't bother me that much, but every so often his characters become kind of his mouthpiece, and I just can't imagine why she would have stayed with him in any way, shape, or form, yes. given the way that he was acting.
Mm-hmm.
He was being a real jerk. I mean, just beyond even, you know, Will levels of occasional jerkism, but he was just full on D-bag in this case.
Yeah, I mean, when he leads off with Dear Penthouse Forum, I think was the moment that it was really obvious how over the top he was being.
Now, I didn't see Neil at all, which is probably all for the best, because given his track record, seeing him would have meant he was doing something incredibly dumb to make things even worse.
Yes.
Interesting the way that Will kind of took things in the direction that he took it this time around. I do agree with you that it was nice for a character to just come out and say that he's been doing all of this for Mackenzie. Again, Sorkin a little bit on the nose there in his autobiographical way that he tends to romance his mm-hmm. own relationships.
Yes.
But yeah, I kind of like that because it does bring it back to a little bit that fairy tale-esque manner in which the second season ended, in that it was really all about the two of them.
Yeah.
And it continues through the end of this episode to be essentially all about them. I mean, granted, it's a rather odd romantic way to end an episode with handcuffs and not in the fun way.
Yes.
Although I don't know, Will kind of gets a little too excited about being the martyr in this case, I think. But there we are.
Yeah, no, but also certainly that whole ending sequence. I mean, I think there have been elements of, you know, when I was talking about the previous episodes, you know, yeah, they've sort of replaced walking and sitting and talking for walking and talking. But certainly that whole final montage with the Ave Maria in the background and everybody running around searching Juilliard for musicians and getting all the stuff together had very much had a early seasons of The West Wing feel to it, which you know, it was nice to see this show getting back into that sort of wheelhouse after some of the fits and starts early on.
Yeah, it's it does have that appeal to it. It almost makes me wish that this show had the same level of following. Mm-hmm. But there we are. Let's see. I just want to check real quick. I don't see him on here yet. I was going to see what Gary thought about this particular one. But we know that he scored it at a 9, and we'll give him the chance if he wants to weigh in on anything after the fact.
Yeah.
But we're going to move into a show.
Actually,
go ahead.
Yeah, no, just the one last thing. I did want to say that the one thing in terms of the internet culture, the Lucas Pruitt, the new buyer, I am finding a little too mustache twirling villainish. But I don't know if that's as much because he's the new guy, and Sorkin looks definitely looks to be very, very deliberately making him the sort of, I mean, the instigator provocateur, where he really does just seem to enjoy pulling out these whether it's crowdsourcing or whichever way he wants to change the division in ways that he knows are just going to tweak all these old media types. But for for now. And of course, they only have two episodes to do anything with them. But yeah, it's that part of it, and the whole dash to try and find the buyer that of course explodes in their faces. That part of it I actually kind of liked, but it still winding up as Lucas Pruitt as the buyer was just a little annoying in the end.
Yeah, there's a part of me that is still wondering if he's just having a really good time playing with their expectations.
Yeah.
That he's going to turn out to not be as big of a problem as they think, and he's just really enjoying messing with their heads in the meantime. And we'll see. I don't know. There, like you said, there's not enough time to really go very far with any of this.
Yeah.
So, well,
yeah, although, yeah.
Whether or not he just turns out to be a straw man, and certainly we've seen Sorkin pull this kind of thing off before, where he likes to do that kind of, you know, let me present a certain type of, whether it be executive or in many cases, political point of view, and lampoon it rather than make it somebody with a really well thought out rationale for why they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
So I could just see him being just either, like you said, mustache twirling guy, or equally possible, just someone who really gets their rocks off by messing with the people that he's going to eventually be acquiring.
Yeah, but certainly the way it's been presented so far is nowhere close to the that white knight that Clark Gregg played in the final episodes of Sports Night.
Yeah, that no, that's a given at this point. I'm fairly sure.
Yeah.
All right, like I said, we can always check in with Gary when he arrives to see if he wants to add anything or add his own commentary on this one. However, I think we can go ahead and move on to a show that I don't think anyone was expecting to be in our top three this week,
no.
Given its track record thus far. Yet here it stands. And this one came in at an average of 8.8, by far the highest score for this show so far. And that would be Constantine. Here's the promo.
With the rising darkness, we gotta stop this thing before it has a mind to kill again.
Be possessed by the spirit of a child. That entity inside is controlling him. I'm here to exorcise an evil spirit. Things you're used to dealing with have more power. Or your old ways might not work.
I bind you to your rightful place!
Constantine. All new, Friday at 10, 9 central after Grimm.
All right, and let me go ahead and bring up the recap. That's Constantine, Season 1, Episode 6, Rage of Caliban. John is forced to put aside his misgivings about exorcising a child when a malevolent spirit takes hold of a young boy. But first, the kid's parents need to be convinced that there is an evil presence controlling their son. All right, and as I said, this came in at 8.8, so that is by far the highest scored episode of Constantine thus far in its first six episodes of its possibly short life.
Yes.
Anywhere from an 8.5 to 9 between all of us, so well above average. Edmund, I mean, you've kind of had a passing interest in this show. What was it that really made you feel like this was a big step up?
To my mind, this was the first episode that I was really finding scary. I mean, even though it was on the surface, it's a possessed kid. It is harking back to The Exorcist. It's a young boy, not a young girl. But the way the tension was built up, early in the episode when the kid's having trouble sleeping and he's afraid of the monsters in the closet, etc. I was really feeling the tension, feeling nervous, and I was comparing it in my mind to the Doctor Who episode Listen that was playing with some of those sort of childhood traumas, and it was like, no, Constantine was really getting under my skin with this. And and then the way they continued it and built it up in terms of the spirit taking over the kid, and also the dynamic then between the parents and Constantine, where their initial reaction is you're a crazy man, get out of here, to then the way he was able to bring first the mother around, and that I thought was very well played out on top of just being a darn good horror show.
Yeah, and well, I think we heard it in the background there. Gary, I believe, has joined us this evening.
Yes, sir, I have.
Excellent, excellent. We are talking about our second highest scored episode of the week, which, to the shock and awe of all of us, has been turned out to be Constantine. This episode, The Rage of Caliban, coming in at 8.8, which is well above average. I mean, clearly one of the better episodes of the fall, and certainly the best episode of Constantine. So for you, I mean, what really brought it up to that level? Because I think even you've been a little bit less than enthusiastic about the consistency of the show up to this point.
Yeah, I have, because honestly, I've felt they're playing it too much exactly like the comic book. You know, it's nice to have it for inspiration, but to actually lift, for all intents and purposes, storylines and just put them on the screen doesn't work. You know, TV is a different medium than a comic book, but I feel like they've been duplicating the comic book so exactly that it fails, because you can't exactly duplicate it, because they're different, you know, they're different presentations of an idea. So it has to change. But this one translated pretty well. You know, it's really the core of his character. And maybe that's the reason, because it's actually hitting on the character where, you know, you have this guy who's, you know, trying to do good, trying to help the less fortunate, not really for money or glory, just because it's the right thing to do. And, you know, and he's able to do so, you know, against what would appear to be difficult odds, figuring out the origin of the possession, and how to resolve it. And, you know, he doesn't give up. He stubbornly, you know, plods through and manages to accomplish it. And, you know, as I said, in this case, it really does mimic the comic books. But because of the rather single-mindedness of the story, it turns out to work well in this instance.
I think that was really the difference for me, was that it was the first time that I was watching it where I felt like they weren't trying to prove anything. They weren't trying to sell us on the portrayal of the character, or just the look of the character, or whatever else you want to call it. Maybe just having it be him, Chaz, and his angel friend, whose name I can't recall off the top of my head. But regardless, it was so focused on him that for the first time after six episodes, I really finally got a sense of who he is, what he's trying to do, and what the story is actually about. There's been so much time trying to set up his female co-lead, in this case, two of them. This is another example also where I feel like the network deciding to air episodes out of order did not help at all. Because this was supposedly the second episode that they did.
Oh, not again.
The one that was the kind of almost the second pilot in many respects.
Uh-huh.
Because they didn't have the other female lead ready to go. So they had this as kind of like the in-between while they were figuring out exactly how to introduce. This would have been such a stronger second episode.
Mm-hmm.
Because even the one that introduced Zed was kind of weak. Plot-wise,
yeah,
it did great in terms of introducing her character, but you needed to know John first before it mattered for you to know her. And that this would have been the perfect. This would have probably solved a lot of the problems that they're having with gaining an audience, because it would have been. I actually feel like this would have been a great pilot. This the story sold it. The character sold it. He wasn't overdoing trying to be Constantine. He was just being the character.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a good observation. Yeah, it doesn't put it introduces the character without shoving him on.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I just feel like this was probably the first time that I feel like the show was actually being able to be itself, if that makes any sense. And that's why it got the kind of score that it got. You could tell that they were being very sincere in the storytelling. Edwin, what anything that you want to add on that?
No, other than just it annoys me that they're playing, although I can see in this case isn't necessarily one of the straight example of, no, they filmed it in a certain order and then they aired it a different way, but I certainly agree this would have been much stronger, and I guess they felt this need to introduce Zed right away, but it does still get to me that we still have these issues of at whichever level it's not happening. I'm sure, especially given the episode the writers and producers are aware that, you know, yes, we need to get to know our main character, but then I can see that's where the next level can step in and says, oh no, you need to introduce the new character right away, and which is why we got that sort of fits and starts of one character getting shuffled off and then the new one coming in, because I know when I saw the original pilot, I wasn't aware of that behind the scenes stuff, and so I was assuming it's like, oh yeah, she says she's going to go away and not be dragged into this, but of course we know she's going to be, and only discover that, oh no, okay, that's papering over this cast change. But given it's possible travails, I'm happy to see the show getting better like this, but it does unfortunately augur that this may be our latest example of something just finding its feet and then not getting a chance to continue it, but we'll just keep our fingers crossed.
Yeah, I mean, because we do have to remember that this show, I think we talked about it before, we're going to talk about it at some point, kind of got cut off at the knees.
Yeah,
as far as the back nine is concerned.
Yeah.
So
yeah, given all of NBC's travails in recent years, I mean, certainly I've six episodes in, I'm a lot more positive about this than I was about something like The Cape or Dracula. So I hope they get a chance to continue working on it, because this is a show that actually feels like it has some legs to it, as opposed to those others where there was really no mourning when they didn't continue.
Hmm. Okay, Gary, anything more that you want to say about Constantine?
No, I wish they could pare down the formula this well in other episodes, but yeah, I hope they can keep this up, although from what you're telling me with the order mixed up, it looks like they already didn't. So.
Right. Yeah, that's the problem. We don't know what the next week is going to look like. This is just like Almost Human all over again. What are we going to get next time, because where is it in the episode order?
Yes.
We don't know. Oh, well. All right, well, we are going to go ahead then and go into our third ranked episode of the week. So rounding up our top three. And this one I don't know that anybody is really surprised by. Coming in at 8.7, we have the latest episode of Arrow. And here is the promo.
It ain't over yet. The Flash versus Arrow matchup continues for one more night.
We do this my way.
Yes. This is going to be awesome.
Who would win, me or you?
When I'm fighting you, it's literally like you're standing still.
Arrow, all new tomorrow at 8, 7 central on the...
All right, and Gary, if you don't mind doing the recap for this one?
Actually, if you can do it for this one, I can't seem to find my notes at the moment.
All right, okay, how about you, Edmund, if you could jump in?
Certainly. My scroll wheel is working. Okay, yes, there it is. Arrow, Season 3, Episode 8, The Brave and the Bold. A crossover event that began on The Flash concludes with Oliver teaming with The Flash to stop a boomerang-wielding killer who plants 5 bombs in the city that are set to explode at the same time.
That's right. And as I said, 8.7, so still pretty good up there, and probably feels like a bit of a return to form after a couple of disappointing episodes of Arrow. Gary, you gave it an 8, which, while it was the lowest of the scores, is still above average. Just your thoughts on this one. And I do realize that it is a little bit odd that we're talking about what is essentially the second half of a loose crossover. But it kind of edged out the first half by a bit. Very little bit, but by a bit.
Well, perhaps in your opinion. Anyway, this is technically the second half of the team up, although these stories really were not directly, I didn't feel directly tied. They tried to throw us a bone or two, talking about Diana Lance's killer, DNA, and some other little incidentals to tie the two, but really they stood on their own pretty well. And this was sort of nice, but it really drove home for me the what's the proper word to use for it? The directness with which Oliver is willing to go to stop people or to protect them, I guess. And I think Flash, brings home is sort of shocked by his methods, and even as he tries to defend him, in the face of what other people says, he realizes that, he probably goes a little bit further than he should for what he does. And it sort of made Oliver seem pathetic, might not be the right word, but somewhat lacking in character that he does have to resort to this violence and actually leans on it as an effective tool for himself.
Interesting. Okay. I will note that, yes, you definitely were among those who gave the Flash episode that came before this a very high score. To be honest, these two are – the difference between these two is at the end of the point.
Yeah.
So it really was just a matter of one edging out the other as an aggregate average. But that's really not the right words to have said there. But anyhow but anyway, Edmund, you felt that the Arrow episode was a bit of an improvement over the Flash one, so the opposite opinion. So what would you have to say to what Gary was bringing up?
Well, certainly, I mean, just
or
in the...
What
would you add? Yeah, no, I mean, I agree that that's what a central conflict between the way Oliver approaches this job or this calling or this cause or whatever you want to call it, and and then the dichotomy they're setting up with the Flash, that whole thing of the Flash being the more traditional hero, the inspirational hero, the one and also to a certain extent it's partially a function of his power as well. Where yeah, I mean his thing is saving people and getting people out of the way, at least at the moment, a lot of the time, and obviously with Oliver, but well, I mean, what I liked about it is they are showing this evolution of Oliver Queen, of where that you know they are openly acknowledging that yes, he used to kill a lot of people back in season one and doesn't want to do that anymore, and whether you agree with his methods or not, I did like the way that they were bringing the flashbacks in to show how that mindset was getting developed during those 5 years of having the situation where he could have gotten the location out of the guy, but was too squeamish basically to get the job done, and how that's now playing into the way he approaches trying to track down the current threat. And so to my mind, I mean, I do like the way that they are both building this universe and staying true to the implications of what these characters have been doing, and in both their cases, I mean, also the little sort of threads they've been dropping in, I mean throughout the Flash's few episodes so far, of Barry getting a little too cocksure and full of himself, and having Oliver bring him down a peg or two, and the whole yes, you can catch the arrow you see, but you can't catch the two that are going into your back. I thought it was, you know, so I kind of like the way they were introducing the dichotomy, and with all the evidence we've had so far, they are going to be using that to try and grow both of the characters. And to my mind, I mean, I guess for me, the tick up in the second episode was that was more when they were starting to directly address that, and even though I'm the Flash episode, they did sort of bring things to a head and capture that villain. It really felt like more of a lead up to the second half.
Mm. So let's see. I don't really know how much I need to add to that, other than the fact that I agree, Gary, in terms of the plot, it was very loosely connected. There wasn't a whole lot that needed to be there. And in fact, there were a couple things here and there that felt the dialogue was one of those, hey, this is the kind of classic cheesy team-up crossover dialogue that you would see in comics, that cheesy crossovers. And it was kind of perfect in that regard. But from a characterization standpoint, I think they managed to justify what they were doing, perhaps a little bit more than I was expecting them to, which was a nice touch.
Well, I think Barry summarized it up best when he starts talking about how Oliver Queen is an inspiration,
mm-hmm.
but not necessarily
no.
Arrow.
No.
That was a great line. I mean, it says a lot about the way that they've been writing both characters on Arrow, both Oliver Queen and it's a good point, but that's also part of Oliver's evolution, because it kind of needs to be something that he keeps in mind, to say the least. All right, so let's see. Gary, before you came in, we had covered the number one show for the week, which was The Newsroom. That episode came in at a 9.0, which is pretty darn high. And obviously, you didn't get a chance to weigh in on that, but any brief thoughts that you wanted to put out there about that episode?
yeah, I thought it was well executed, but I saw the path it was taking very early on. The cockiness that that he would not be arrested seemed to be a little bit heavily foreshadowing the fact that he would be. So that was probably my only fault. If Will had gone in just slightly less determined that he would not be thrown into jail, I think I might have perhaps even gone higher on the episode, but it just seemed a little too telegraphed for me. I would have liked a little surprise.
And then the other thing that we got to talk about, which I was really curious about your opinion of, was this casting information about Suicide Squad. And I don't know if you had a chance to look at that article or not, but I'm curious as to your thoughts about it. The casting seems a little overdone to me, if you know what I mean. Will Smith as Deadshot, Jared Leto as the Joker. I think it was Tom Hardy who played Bane in The Dark Knight Rises is going to be which character was it again? I don't know if they named the character, but
that was Rick Flagg, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it may have been.
Yeah.
So yeah, it seems like they're really trying to get the highest profile people they can get, which I don't know, Jared Leto as the Joker, but anyway.
Well, now we talked about this though. DC desperately, I think, and that's the right word, desperately wants a big successful movie. They're sitting on the sidelines now, watching Marvel literally, bat one out of the park after another, and they want that big hit, and they're hoping by pulling moderately good star power into it that's going to be something that's going to propel that forward. Of course, we know it has to be story, but and maybe they even do too, but they want to stack the deck, and I can see where they're coming from. They're really trailing behind in the whole movie war, if you want to call it that. So they want a hit. They want a big hit. They want Avengers and Guardians of the Galaxy rolled up as far as numbers go. So they're stacking the deck the best they can, and it concerns me because I feel that there might be trading on names rather than story. But we'll see. I think the Suicide Squad is that sort of eclectic mix of characterizations, much like Guardians of the Galaxy is. So I'm hopeful. I never particularly cared for the franchise myself, but there are a lot of people that do.
Hmm. Okay, fair enough. Yeah, it's just I'm concerned that they're overplaying their hand on this one. And unless they go for something that may, like, if they went a little camp with it, kind of like a knowing wink to the audience throughout, it might work out pretty well with a cast like this, but I'm wondering if it just is, like, too big of a cast. They're kind of rolling the dice here and just saying, you know what, if we blow it, we're going to blow it big. We're going to, go all out or go home. But,
well, I think, it sort of reminds me of that movie that that's been out, that they've been doing a few of, The Expendables, where it grabs all the Stallone and Lundgren and all those sort of people. And yeah, maybe they are going for a bit of camp. It wouldn't surprise me given the list of stars that they've mentioned. But like I said, I think they're trying really, really hard, and I hope I wonder if it's too hard or it's not the right focus for what they're trying to do. But they want hit and they want it bad. So I hope they're not getting too desperate in that sense. I'd rather have a moderately successful, well based movie than just names on a on a poster.
Yeah, exactly. I mean that's my fear, is that they're focusing more on that, and just when you get the egos involved, it's like, okay, are we going to get the amount of is the emphasis going to be in the right place, is I guess where my concern is, but we'll see. Well, I mean, we all thought that Guardians of the Galaxy was a questionable thing to put out there, and boy were we proven wrong. So yes. There you go. Alright, I think we're going to go ahead and wrap up this show here, and when we come back next time, we are going to continue with some of this week's genre news, and we're going to look at some of the shows that maybe weren't as successful this time around.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under the Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.